May it please the Court, Your Honors, Francis Murphy for the appellants. I wanted to begin the argument with a brief discussion of the facts because the facts and the law in this matter are intertwined. First, I wanted to start with the course of medical care of Heather Turner, the appellant. On July 24, 2007, the defendant, Dr. Kalish, performed a routine laparoscopic appendectomy on Mrs. Turner. The surgery had to be done urgently because she was suffering from appendicitis. The doctor reported that it was an uncomplicated procedure. It was a laparoscopic procedure, meaning she was not subject to having her entire abdomen opened. And she should have recovered from that appendectomy without any complications whatsoever. However, 8 days later, on August 1, 2007, Mrs. Turner returned with a partial small bowel obstruction, not a complete obstruction. It was diagnosed as a partial obstruction. The defense expert was Dr. Matthew Kirkland, and he testified that over the last 15 to 20 years in the medical profession, there has been a movement to treat both partial and complete bowel obstructions, as long as they are uncomplicated, meaning without infection, without surgery, and that conservative treatment could extend for as much as 30 days. It was the plaintiff's position that Dr. Kalish rushed her to surgery approximately 24 hours after she was admitted to the hospital. In the surgery, Dr. Kalish removed 1 inch, a mere 1 inch of small bowel. At his deposition, he testified that it was the discoloration, bruising, purple color of the bowel, which led him to conclude that that 1 inch of bowel was unhealthy and needed to be removed. However, his testimony at his deposition did not square with the pathology report that was done after the surgery and was not available till Ms. Turner had left the hospital. And the pathology report is in the plaintiff's appendix at A647 and 648. Your Honors will see, if you review the pathology report, that it did not report any bruising of that 1 inch of bowel whatsoever. It was pink, tan, glistening, healthy tissue. The pathologist, of course, is obligated to open the 1 inch of bowel and look at the inside. He looked at the inside and he reported pink, tan, glistening, healthy tissue. He did have two other findings with respect to it. He mentioned hemorrhage along one margin, which of course could be readily explained by the fact that this piece of bowel had been cut and removed. Probably wondering why this 1 inch of small bowel had been removed, because it appeared perfectly healthy, he did a microscopic examination and he found one focal point of ulceration, which he did not mention in his gross description because obviously he could not see it grossly with his naked eye. He saw it under the microscope. This microscopic area of ulceration, of course, was inside the bowel and could not have been seen by Dr. Kalish when he was making the decision whether to remove this 1 inch of healthy bowel. Mrs. Turner's highly qualified expert, Dr. Howard Beaton, opined that Dr. Kalish failed to provide non-operative treatment for a sufficient time. He was of the opinion that it was more likely than not, just as in the majority of cases, as testified to by the defense expert, this bowel obstruction would have resolved uneventfully. Furthermore, he testified that, okay, even though the doctor did the surgery, when he got inside, he could see that the bowel was healthy. The only problem that existed was it was adherent to the staple line where the appendectomy had been performed. All he had to do was release that area, cut the adhesion, and leave the bowel alone. But Dr. Kalish did not do that. We know that months later, on November 30, 2007, Turner had to return to the hospital with a second small bowel obstruction, which was in the same area as the first obstruction. And I want to note that you couldn't have told that from Dr. Conway's operative report, Dr. Kalish's partner who performed the second small bowel surgery. The area of the small bowel that was implicated was not described in sufficient detail in the operative report of Dr. Conway for Dr. Beaton, the plaintiff's expert, to identify it. The only way that he was able to identify it was from a handwritten note post-op by Dr. Conway, in which there was a drawing which identified the area of the small bowel, and it implicated the same area that Dr. Kalish had operated on. The fact that the obstruction occurred in precisely the same area signified to Dr. Beaton, the plaintiff's expert, that the earlier bowel surgery had caused unnecessary adhesions and which therefore had caused the second bowel obstruction. Now, Dr. Conway performed that second surgery on December 2, 2007. He even waited longer, despite the very serious nature of the second bowel obstruction, he even waited longer than Dr. Kalish had waited before performing surgery. But he did not dictate his operative report until almost 2 months later on January 23, 2008. Later in 2008, Turner again experienced abdominal pain and a mass was found on her liver. On September 26, 2008, Dr. Joseph Bennett performed surgery to remove the mass on the liver. When Dr. Bennett dictated his operative report the same day as the surgery, he said this about the contaminated mass: "My impression was that this could have been some sort of spillage from her intra-abdominal operation, such as appendicillolith or small piece of stool or inflammatory process from her prior surgery that tunneled down in the posterior hepatic space and Morrison space." Thus, Dr. Bennett, in his operative report, which again was dictated right after the surgery, contained information suggesting that one of the prior there had been spillage from one of the prior surgeries. The same year as the trial, on January 10, 2012, Mrs. Turner underwent yet another surgery, this one by Dr. Wesley Clayton and Dr. Lawrence Chang, to repair a very large incisional hernia caused by the two unnecessary laparotomies done by Dr. Kalish and Dr. Conway. All of this from an uncomplicated appendectomy, which the plaintiff should have recovered from uneventfully. We know from the discovery in the case, because a subpoena was served on ChristianaCare, that there is a rule that requires operative reports to be dictated within 24 hours or before there is a change in the patient's level of care. I refer to it as the 24-hour rule. Statistics are kept on whether the surgeons meet this requirement, and based on the documents produced by ChristianaCare, the surgeons who operate there have been meeting that in about 90% of cases or more. If you look at the pretrial stipulation, which is in the appendix, we had subpoenaed a witness from ChristianaCare to appear at the trial to testify about the 24.
Does that mean that 10% of the cases there's negligence?
Not necessarily. What it could mean, Your Honor, is this. Someone is shot in the city of Wilmington. They have multiple gunshot wounds. They are rushed to Christiana Hospital. A surgeon who may be asleep or getting off his shift or whatever, or just finished a surgery, has to go in at maybe 1 or 2 in the morning and perform an operation, a complicated operation that could take 5 or 6 hours. Does that mean that surgeon has to go right then, right after, and dictate an operative report? Absolutely not, and I would not argue that. If he had done his operative report day later, 2 days later, 3 days later, a week later, we wouldn't be here. But this is a situation where it was 52 days later, and it involved a procedure where his partner was implicated and he himself was implicated. And they had known.
And the inferences to be drawn from that delay are what?
The first inference to be drawn is that although he had several days to plan for the surgery, he rushed through the surgery, he had too many surgeries on his calendar, and he didn't have time to dictate the operative report timely. The 52 days, that's completely inexplicable. Okay. Why in the 52-day period he didn't find time to dictate the person's operative report, even though the patient had been discharged five weeks before that?
Well, all of this is something that could have been or perhaps was, argued to the jury based on the 52-day delay as opposed to the 24-hour rule, right?
Your Honor, I concede that the trial court allowed us to prove that it was 52 days late. What that left us to argue, though, was that against Dr. Conway, that you're allowed to do this whenever you want. There's really no requirement. There's no specific requirement to dictate it within a day or two. I just got busy. What's the big deal? Well, it is a big deal because it's a national requirement. Hospitals are required to keep statistics on it. All of the surgeons who testified admitted at deposition that it was a rule that they were aware of that was required at any hospital where they had performed surgery.
Here's the struggle from one perspective anyway. Everything you just said sounds to me like it's a peer review issue, and perhaps there's some internal hospital discipline that should be applied to this doctor for failing to adhere to a well-recognized, well-accepted rule that's grounded in quality of medical care. I get all that. But this case isn't the issue. What is the relationship between a failure to do the post-op report within 24 hours and the alleged negligence or causation from that negligence related to your client's injury?
Your Honor, I understand that that's what the trial court concluded. I disagree with that conclusion, and here's why. Impeachment, evidence that can go to impeach the a party in the case is not limited to something that is actually tied to causation.
Unless I misread the briefs, there are two issues. First, should it have been admitted as substantive evidence of negligence or causation, or was it admissible only for impeachment purpose with presumably a cautionary instruction? Neither happened, right? All you
got
to tell the jury was 52 days later. And they were left to speculate about, so what? What does that mean? In a vacuum. Now, what are you arguing to us now? That there is a substantive basis to infer negligence or causation, or simply that it should have been admitted with a cautionary instruction for impeachment purposes?
Both, Your Honor. It should have been admitted for both. And my expert was prepared to say, and he had disclosed in his pretrial expert disclosures, that this is a rule that's nationally accepted. It applies to all hospitals. It applies to surgeons doing the surgeries. And it is the standard of care. So you are required to do it. Was it related to the negligence? Yes, because of my argument that he rushed through the surgery. He was too busy even to dictate the operative report for 52 days, and that's why there was spillage.
Okay,
because he rushed through.
I just want to make sure I understand this.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand your point on how it's related to establishing the standard of care and a breach of that standard of care. I get that. But the next step is, did that breach cause the damage to your client? Because superficially anyway, subject to your explanation to me, one could look at this and say, well, it's post-operative. And the real allegation is the operation itself and the negligence that occurred in the breach of the standard of care in performing the operation caused the injury. The failure to do the report on time had no rational relationship between the injury itself. Is that wrong?
I believe so, Your Honor. It is circumstantial evidence that the surgeon did not take and have sufficient time adequately to perform this complex surgery. He didn't take sufficient time after he completed the bowel resection. He didn't take sufficient time to clean out the abdomen, hence the spillage.
Don't the medical records show when the surgery started and when the surgery ended? I mean, can't you still make that argument if it was too short a time period?
Yes, Your Honor, but I'm making the argument without some of the major evidence that I have to support it.
Answering brief, they put a lot of focus on the pathology report showing no spillage. So tell us the connection between the contemporaneous pathology report that doesn't show any evidence of a problem and your circumstantial argument that there was a problem.
Your Honor, I addressed that in detail in the reply brief, and the answer is this.
Okay.
My expert testified, and no one disagreed, that the device that is used to cut and divide the bow minimizes spillage. It does not eliminate. That's number one. Number two, their assertion was, look at the pathology report, where there were multiple pieces of small bow that were submitted to the pathologist that were not closed at the end. There were four pieces. Two of them were open. Only two of them were closed. If the two open pieces could have been the consequence of the spillage. Moreover, he didn't describe what he did in the operative report very well. So
how do those multiple pieces relate to the one-inch section you were talking about earlier?
In the first surgery, the bow was healthy. It shouldn't have been touched. It should have been left alone. The second surgery was necessary. Because of the unnecessary surgery by Dr. Kalish, the area adhesed. And, of course, we don't know specifically in great detail what Dr. Conway saw when he opened her up because he waited 52 days to dictate the report. He didn't even indicate in the report exactly where the obstruction was.
But did you make all of those arguments to the jury?
I made as many of them as I could. The problem was my part of the case was blunted to a significant degree because Dr. Kalish was permitted to testify as an expert before his expert ever got on the witness stand. And the matters that I could have used to challenge Dr. Conway's credibility, for example, the fact that he denied under oath the existence of a rule that everybody else knew about and is in the records of Christiana Care, and he held a senior position in the Department of Surgery and claims to not know about it, I wasn't permitted to lay a glove on either one of these two doctors.
We understand. And you can see from our questions, though, we're talking about what the jury would comprehend based on your argument. Let's suppose it was just a witness, nothing to do with an operative report, and the practice is for the police that you interview a witness at the scene or the next day. But the police don't do that. They interview the witness 52 days later. Wouldn't a jury understand that your recollection 52 days later is not as good as it would be contemporaneously?
I would hope that they would. But the difference is that the doctor was denying that. The doctor was saying, I remembered what the surgery was about. And I wasn't even allowed to prove that there were at least 27 intervening surgeries that might have gummed up his recollection. So, I mean, the jury, I served discovery to find out how many surgeries Dr. Conway did between Mrs. Turner's surgery and the day he dictated the operative report. And the answer came back, at least 27. These are at the hospital and don't include procedures at his office. At least 27. I wasn't allowed to prove that. Well, so he's sitting there saying, I remember everything.
All right, but that's a different issue, isn't it? Is that an issue on appeal, that you couldn't raise the 27 intervening surgeries?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
The trial judge precluded me.
I know he did that, but in your brief, it appears your only argument is the 24-hour rule.
Your Honor, I thought it was clear in my opening brief. If it's not, it certainly is clear in the reply brief.
All right, but under our rule,
10 ways.
No, under our rules, it has to be clear in your opening brief.
Well, Your Honor, I thought it was absolutely clear in the opening brief.
All right.
I know the answering brief went to that. Well, the other things are just, how can they be defended? How can the trial judge say in the middle of the trial that all of these intervening surgeries that happened could not affect his memory, and therefore you're not going to be allowed to prove it?
Did you only have 45 seconds left, including your rebuttal time. Did you want to talk about your problems with the notice of what Dr. Kalish would testify to? Is that, you want to leave that on the briefs?
I don't have the time, Your Honor. I apologize, and I hope I've answered all of the court's questions.
Thank you. Practice of law can be very frustrating. Just calm down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Good morning, opposing counsel.
The issue, as I see it in the case, is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in making evidentiary rulings on the motion in limine and also on the testimony at trial regarding Dr. Kalish. On this issue regarding this 24-hour rule, I think it's important to know that in the facts of the case and plaintiff's experts, there was absolutely no criticisms regarding the accuracy of the report when Dr. Beacon was first deposed. He was asked the question, are you critical of the surgery performed by Dr. Conway on December 2nd, 2007? No. If I can just qualify that a little bit, if we're talking about the operative note and the manner in which he conducted the surgery, I found no criticisms. It was then after that deposition that they found a 24-hour rule and attempted to now implicate the timing of this rule in the case. Dr. Beaton was deposed again and asked a series of questions about whether that report had any problems of accuracy, of whether or not the timing of that 24-hour rule caused any injury. And he says, in your opinion, did it cause her to develop a hernia? It's sort of obvious in mistaking things. The timing of this operative report has nothing to do with the development of the hernia. He's then asked about her other conditions, her malabsorption, her diarrhea, her irritable bowel syndrome, and says it's not. And the reason is because the focus of this case was whether or not there was something that occurred intraoperatively during the procedure itself.
Well, as I understand Mr. Murphy's position, it's that all of these operations, to the extent they are performed routinely, would have operative notes that are strikingly similar, because you would assume everything proceeds in due course. What he's saying is that when you dictate something 52 days later, you might not have included something in your plain vanilla routine operative report that you remembered right at the time that was particular to that procedure.
But there's no evidence of that in this case. The doctor handwrites a progress note on an operative note. He handwrites that, and then the patient is followed. The issue of what is precluded is, do you have to do it with 24 hours? So that's the alleged breach that they had. Now the question becomes, does that breach cause any injury? And in every medical negligence case, there may be a series of breaches that occur, and then the focal point is whether those breaches cause injury. So the issue is, now can we allow the plaintiff to bring up an issue on a 24-hour rule, whether the report is dictated 2 days later or 52 days later, is bringing a breach of the standard of care that causes injury, to now sort of show the doctor is a bad doctor because he didn't do it during that period of time.
Well, what about the alternative about impeachment? Doesn't it allow an inference that the doctor knows the rule, that there's something afoot by the delay, and that in any event the report itself is inaccurate?
Nothing about the rule would imply to impeachment. He had the report. The jury knew it was 52 days later.
He denied even the existence of the rule.
Well, but I guess the point is, if impeachment deals with the accuracy of the report was in evidence.
Well, impeachment deals with the credibility of the witness. Here's a witness that, at least as I understand the record, says he doesn't know about the rule. And we understand he's a surgeon that's had privileges at this hospital for some period of time. And we understand from the other testimony that there's a 90%, if not better, adherence to the rule. It's a protocol that's in place, rule, regulation, for the purpose of monitoring the quality of care. There are reports that come out of it, and typically in the hospital scenario, you look at those who don't comply with the rules, you try to find out why, you do a peer review and determine whether it merits discipline. So it has a reason to exist. It's almost impossible to believe that the witness says he doesn't know the rule exists and not have that affect his credibility. Why is there a limitation on the opportunity to impeach his credibility based on that one statement and the existence of the rule?
Because if the purpose of the rule is dealing with the accuracy of the report is in evidence, and the jury knows it's 52 days later. That there's no indication that that report looks different on day 52 than it would have on day two.
I think one of us is missing the other's point here. I'm talking simply about admissibility with a cautionary instruction that the jury should consider this solely for the purpose of determining the witness's credibility when the witness says he doesn't know of the existence of a rule. The rule exists. Every surgeon presumably would know about the rule unless they're on the job for the first time that week. Why isn't that possible? Why isn't it appropriate, proper, to allow the plaintiff to impeach the doctor's credibility on the basis he doesn't know of the existence?
Because now you're getting into a breach of a standard of care that has no approximate, even for purposes of impeachment. If you're talking about a rule, and I understand this is to attack the credibility of the witness, I mean, that report is there. There's 52 days that there. Whether the rule is 2 days or 52 days, it goes to the accuracy of the report. So there was no definitive evidence that that was going to...
But that's the problem we're having. You keep saying the accuracy of the report. And what the other side wanted to do was impeach the witness and thereby challenge the accuracy of the report. So if we start with the premise that the report's accurate, so it doesn't matter what happened because the report's accurate, you're missing the point that the plaintiff wanted to make, which is he says the report is accurate, but he didn't even admit there was a rule. So if he's not admitting a rule that's well known to everyone, how can we assume he hasn't admitted an inaccuracy in the report?
Well, there's if the purpose is to show that he did some bad act by not dictating it within a period of time, how is that definitively germane to whether or not he breached the standard of care intraoperatively in terms of his act? And the trial court was faced with this issue on the use of the...
But you see, that's, I think I'm having the same problem the Chief Justice had, where you and I aren't talking about the same thing. We're putting aside breaches of the standard of care for the purpose of showing substantive medical malpractice. That's why we're talking about a limiting instruction. And what the judge would say, there was a 24-hour rule. You're not allowed to consider it as evidence of malpractice. However, to the extent the rule existed and this surgeon denied his knowledge of the existence of the rule, you're allowed to consider it for assessing his credibility.
Because the report itself is simply a reflection of his credible reporting of what occurred during the operation. To have a medical expert later look at the report and say, well, I don't see anything unreasonable in the report, is premised on the assumption that everything in the report, as dictated, is truthful. The impeachment of the doctor on this particular issue raises, at least at a minimum, a question about whether that report contained truthful statements about what happened during the operation.
But there is a report that's done. There is an initial narrative, handwritten report that's done. And then there's progress notes that it's done. So there are contemporary, and there's a preoperative histories, and then there's a pathology report that comes out after that. So there is contemporaneous documentation as to what occurred during that period of time.
And that all goes, that's your argument on why he is credible. But we'd agree that your postoperative handwritten notes aren't simply transcribed. Because if transcribing the notes was all you had to do, you'd never have to dictate a report. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, they generally add information, or they put different information in a dictated report, but there is a handwritten report. And actually what he does is he sort of diagrams the operation itself as to what he actually did. So I would argue that that issue is not necessarily impeachment of his credibility in terms of his ability as a surgeon to do the operation in an appropriate manner. We're talking about a report. There's no question this guy is a very qualified surgeon and knows what he's doing. So they want to argue he's too busy. There's absolutely no evidence in this case that he was too busy. They want to argue somehow he's covering his partner. There's absolutely no evidence in this case that he's covering for his partner. So it's kind of a 403. We're now going to go into some potential evidence that we could use towards credibility. The question is, what's the prejudice that results from that? Now you have the jury going off on this.
Well, I thought the ruling was not based on prejudice. The ruling was based on confusing the jury, mixing up the significance of the report with a breach of the standard of care, which related to the time of the operation, not something that occurred 52 days later. Am I wrong about that? Was there some finding?
Confusion of the jury is part of that. I don't know if it was.
Was there a finding that somehow it's unduly prejudicial to impeach somebody's credibility? Impeaching their credibility is inherently an attempt to prejudice them.
I understand. I think the
question is unfair or not.
I think the concern was about the admissibility of this evidence and the jury going off on a tangent regarding the breach of the standard of care.
So it's confusing the jury is the basis of the ruling.
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes, sir. But now this is a small issue. And if you want to talk about it solely related to what the report says or it does, there's absolutely, the plaintiff's expert reviews the report and says, I have no criticisms regarding that report looks like any other report.
Well, we know that because we've heard that, and it's because he has no reason to believe it's not truthful.
And
it looks like the kind of postoperative report the ordinary doctor under ordinary circumstances might dictate. We get that. That's not the point of the impeachment.
And Your Honor, can I just go back? If you're talking about impeaching the credibility of a witness regarding the timing of the rule, you're relating it to the sort of accuracy of that report in being late. In other words, the plaintiffs want to say...
No, we're relating it to the possibility that if this doctor does not tell the truth about knowledge of the existence of a 24-hour timetable for a post-operative report, he may not be telling the truth about what's in that report. It attacks his credibility, raises a question in the jury's mind about should they believe what he actually put in the report.
Your Honor, I would argue it's a very small point in the overall credibility of this witness.
That may be.
And that issue... in terms of whether you have to do it within 24 hours or do it within 52 days.
A very small point. The issue for us is it something that the plaintiff was entitled to be able to use to attack a critical witness's testimony on the basis of lack of credibility? Or was he foreclosed improperly from having that opportunity?
I would argue he was not foreclosed improperly because...
Well, let's say we have beaten this rented mule long enough, and let's turn to the Kalish argument. Did you give adequate notice of what he would testify to as an expert before trial?
Your Honor, Dr. Kalish is the defendant in the case, and part of this pathology report is the factual history of the case, not just some opinion. In other words, he did the report on August 2nd, and then the pathology came back on August 8th, and he, in the course of his practice, would have received it. He was deposed by the plaintiff's attorney and was asked a question about the length of small bowel was compromised, in your opinion. My operative report says 1 inch. It could have been 2 inches. It could have been 3 inches. I think the pathology report is fairly indicative of a similar length. And then he's asked a question, well, was it too narrow to leave it alone? Says one description's narrowed, meaning the lumen or the size of the interior part of it is compromised. And I also didn't include it in my operative report, but the acute inflammation, he's referring to the pathology report, and the appearance of the wall of the bowel is a factor in that decision as well.
So in giving that testimony, was he testifying as to historical fact, in other words, what he was thinking at the time he was reading the report? Or was he extrapolating, addressing issues that he was not?
I think it was a little bit of both because that report came back and he was now given a deposition, which was probably a couple years later, so there may have been some retroactive reflection. But the point is...
And 2 years might matter, but 52 days would not, if we're just talking about recollections.
Well, some people have better memory than others, and some people remember things with incredible detail. I've had witnesses who years later recall surgeries and items with incredible detail, and some who don't. There was no indication he had any problem with his recollection, and he couldn't remember it. It was a factual recitation of the care and treatment that he gave. The plaintiffs were on notice that the pathology report was an issue in the case. They clearly knew that because their expert only addressed it in a small part to say that it showed some inflammation.
Is it accurate that Dr. Kalish testified that the August 8, 2007 pathology report supported his decision to operate on the plaintiff?
It corroborated his decision to operate.
It was done after, but it supported in the sense that he was offering an opinion that the report solidified his view that he should have operated.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Was the plaintiff put on notice that he would testify to that?
Well, he was put on notice that the pathology report of what it showed, and he was put on notice in the deposition many times about his justification for surgery, and he talks about the acute inflammation.
All right. Perhaps things have changed, but I thought during at least my practice more than a few years ago, that when you identified an expert, you were obligated not only to give the name, how they could be reached for the purpose of taking their deposition, the curriculum vitae, but you were also supposed to give the facts upon which they relied in giving an opinion and the nature and substance of that opinion. Was that notice given before trial that Dr. Kalish would testify that his review of the pathology report supported his decision to operate?
It was given in the sense that he had given a pre-deposition, and the disclosure said that he would testify consistent with his deposition.
Was something given in writing to the plaintiff that said, Dr. Kalish will offer in support of his opinion that it was appropriate to operate, the fact that the pathology report supported that decision in the following way?
No, Your Honor, because the deposition, I thought the Bush case said that the deposition could be used as part of that.
The case says the pretrial deposition testimony has to be consistent with the trial testimony.
Yes, sir.
Was it consistent?
Yes, sir. His testimony.
So he offered that opinion during the deposition.
He stated during the deposition that it was too narrowed, and he talks about the pathology report, and he talks about the pathology report showing acute inflammation. I would argue that he is essentially saying that acute inflammation that seems there is part of what I'm seeing, part of what's justifying me doing that surgery. And I also want to point out there's a harmless error argument to this as well, because our expert, Dr. Kirkland, you know, had clearly indicated this and testified to this in his deposition and during his trial. What essentially happened, Your Honor, is the plaintiff had not focused on the pathology report. His expert in deposition and statements just made a kind of mere reference to it. Then at trial, and there's a dynamic aspect to trial where things gain more emphasis. Now the plaintiff's lawyer is comparing with his expert that pathology report to Conway's pathology report and making a big point of saying that this doesn't prove that he should have gone in and do the operation. So Dr. Kalish, being a defendant in a case, is now responding in part. It was mentioned. It was clearly a focus because the plaintiff's lawyer mentioned it and made it a focus as well and knew about it from our expert. And Dr. Kalish is merely, you know, responding and explaining in sort of a factual way why that report supports his decision to do the operation. And clearly his deposition testimony and the crux of his defense was,
so
I needed to go in and
remove this
tissue. Testifying
that the pathology report supports his decision to operate is factual. Is that what you're telling me?
It's part of his care and treatment of this patient.
I understand that, but is that not giving an opinion as opposed to being a fact witness?
I think it could potentially be both, but in a medical doctor context, there's many things that are part of their care and treatment which are sort of the facts of the case that lead to the breaches of the standard of care. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
I believe I have only 30 seconds. Justice Holland, the argument about the other factors in addition to the 24-hour rule are contained at pages 20 to 27 of our opening brief. Dr. Kalish's testimony was not merely factual. He testified that a focal point of ulceration would develop into a serious small bowel defect. That's not an observation of fact, and he could not have seen the focal point of ulceration during the surgery before he cut the bowel because it was inside. He testified that you could see this ulceration with the naked eye, even though the pathologist did not report it with his naked eye and only found it under the microscope. The substance of his opinions were not disclosed at his deposition. The pathology report was not marked. The only reference he made to it was that it showed that about one inch of small bowel was removed. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.